This is the second day of this January 2011 seven-day session. And we'll resume reading from our text of yesterday, which is the collected works of Chino. Chino being a 12th century Korean Zen master. And this book was translated with an introduction by Robert Buswell, Jr. For people who wonder why I always try to remember to say the author and translator, it's for those who are hearing this on tape. Now, remember from yesterday that when he and others formed this, what they call Samadhi and Prajna community, to commemorate the inauguration of that, he gave wrote a text, and this is the text: encouragement to practice the compact of the Samadhi and Prajna community. And as usual, I'll just be reading bits of it because it's way too long to read all of it. So this was written in 1190 when he was 33 years old to commemorate the establishment of the Samadhi and Prajna community. And he starts off, "Reverently I have heard." And then he cites a metaphor from earlier times. A person who falls to the ground gets back up by using that ground. To try to get up without relying on that ground would be impossible. And there's a footnote here that will clarify this a bit. We're told that this was adapted by Chino from a verse of the fourth Indian ancestor, Upagupta, whose name appears in our full ancestral line. Here's the full verse or passage. Just as one who has fallen to the ground must use that ground to help himself up, all sentient beings who have fallen down onto the fundamental wisdom of their own minds must use that very same wisdom to pick themselves up. And then the translator adds this: since all defiled and pure things derive from the one mind, deluded sentient beings fall into the dirt, that is, the defilements of the ground, the ground being the one mind, when they ignorantly become involved with defiled sensual objects. But by the same token, they must get up from this same ground in order to enter the pure realm of enlightenment. To raise themselves out of the morass of the defilements without relying on the mind ground would be impossible. Indeed, as Chinul stresses, for a practice to be successful, it must be centered in an understanding of the fundamental mind essence, or what we could call our true nature. Once the practice is properly grounded, students can use their efforts to best advantage when it comes to standing up. And now back to the text itself. Chino continues, sentient beings are those who are deluded in regard to the one mind and give rise to boundless defilements. Buddhas are those who have awakened to the one mind and have given rise to boundless sublime functions. Although there is a difference between delusion and awakening, essentially both derive from the one mind. So to seek Buddhahood or enlightenment apart from the mind is impossible. This is sort of the the very core of Zen teaching. Since my youth, I have cast myself into the domain of the patriarchs and have visited meditation halls everywhere. After investigating the teachings which the Buddha and patriarchs so compassionately bestowed on beings, I find that they are primarily designed to make us cease all conditioning, empty the mind, and remain centered there quietly without looking for anything outside. As it is stated in the Avatamsaka Sutra, already here he's bringing in the sutra of another Buddhist school. If a person wants to comprehend the state of Buddhahood, he should purify his mind until it is just like empty space. And of course, that's what we're doing in our practice. What all Zen practices have in common, whether it's a breath practice or koan or anything else, what they all have in common is that they enable us, they are a method or tool for emptying the mind. In Zen, we're not trying to effect a change, as in some other Buddhist schools. For example, in metta meditation, where the idea is to try to radiate loving kindness, and in most other kinds of meditation, maybe all other kinds of meditation, there is something you're trying to do, trying to get to some place or create a state of mind. But in Zen, we're trying to flush all states of mind away. We're trying to empty the mind of everything, all thought forms, ideas, concepts, notions, images. And this happens, it's not that we do it exactly, but the more absorbed we are in our particular practice, the more this just happens willy-nilly. The mind becomes more empty. This is what we will see happening as over the next few days. So again, it's not that we're doing anything exactly. It's like one of those Christmas or those snow globes that are all, you see the snow all in commotion. We don't have to open up the globe and press down on all those little snowflakes. We don't have to get rid of them somehow. We just have to allow them to settle. And, of course, the fastest way for them to settle is as we're doing a lot of sitting. Sitting is settling. But if I can maybe just get a little ahead of our text here, it's not just the settling. The settling is the first step, to let all those snowflakes settle. But the real point is that once they're settled, then the water, the mind becomes clear and transparent, and we can see to the bottom of this vessel we call mind. So there's the settling, and then there's the seeing, the awakening, the insight. It's not that they're two successive steps. It's really it's one process. As the thoughts settle, we see into the nature of the mind. We see, what do we see? First, we see that nothing in the mind can be trusted. That there will always be thoughts kicking around in the mind. And with thoughts, we don't want to have anything to do with any thoughts. And then beyond that is seeing what is beyond the thoughts. And then Chinyo continues. The last thing he said was, if a person wants to comprehend the state of enlightenment, he should purify his mind until it is just like empty space. Nevertheless, when we examine the inclination of our conduct from dawn to dusk, we see that we rely on the Buddha Dharma while adorning ourselves with the signs of self and person. Infatuated with material welfare and submerged in secular concerns, we do not cultivate virtue, but only waste food and clothing. He's addressing his monks here, making the point that if they're not working at their practice, then they are wasting food and clothing. Although we have left home, leaving home is a direct translation of becoming ordained, monastic ordination. Although we have left home, what merit does it have? How sad. We want to leave the triple world, but we do not practice freeing ourselves from sensual objects. The triple world is just an ancient formulation, a phrase that means the whole world of samsara, basically, of suffering. People may wonder, well, as a celibate monk living in a monastery, what kind of sensual objects can you hang on to? Well, where there's a will, there's a way. And my experience in the monastic environments in Japan, where I spent some time, is that most of it gets boiled down to food, attachment to food. The monks and the nuns there, I saw them eat unbelievable quantities of food. I was flabbergasted at this one, especially this one sticks in my mind. Little scrawny little nun, she must have weighed about 85 pounds, and that's about how much rice was in her bowl. But there was a at mealtime, what a surge of craving gets focused on food, because there isn't much else. And food is pretty basic. From one standpoint, we fail in the Dharma's propagation. From another, we are negligent in benefiting sentient beings. And between these two, we turn our backs on our four benefactors. This, I think, is a Confucian allusion, but I'm not sure. There's no footnote, so I won't venture to guess. This is indeed shameful. All this has made me lament since long ago. I think what we can take from this as lay people is how stubborn and tenaciously we look to sense pleasures over the Dharma, over sitting. How sitting, I think, for most people gets relegated to just a small corner of their life. I bet if we did a survey and an honest response would show that people spend at least as much time at their computers trawling websites and fooling around on their computer as they do sitting. We can't expect to change our lives in any significant way if we apportion time like that, or in front of TV, or whatever one does to decompress. And then skipping here to the next page, although we monks are born in the degenerate age of the Dharma and our basic characters are dull and stupid, if even we shrink in discouragement and seek the path while grasping at appearances, who else will be able to practice the sublime approach of samadhi and prajna as followed by past adepts? If the difficulty of the practice causes us to renounce it and not cultivate it, then since we do not train now, even though we pass through innumerable kalpas, the practice will only become more difficult. But if we cultivate assiduously now, the practices which are difficult will, due to the power of our training, gradually become easy. Well, we can apply this, change the time sense here to just within this week of Sesshin. Already I've heard from people who are getting frustrated and a little discouraged at how much resistance they're meeting up with and their efforts to stay with their practice. The drowsiness that they feel is holding them back, the thoughts, the power of thoughts to keep hijacking the mind. But this is what we have to expect in the early stage of Sesshin. We can't, After allowing our minds to scatter here and there, chasing after every kind of pleasure and preoccupation, they're not going to stop on a dime when we come in, even in these ideal conditions of silence and so much sitting. There's a momentum that carries on, and it takes a steadfast effort to have these snowflakes of the mind settle. But as he says, if we cultivate assiduously now, if we practice, make a strong effort in our practice, the practices which are difficult will gradually become easy. Well, easier for sure. Everyone finds this in Sesshin, that it's a lot easier to keep the mind on the practice on day 6 than it is on day 2. We may never be satisfied. We may never be satisfied till we are in a state of true samadhi, deep absorption, deep silence of the mind, but it does get easier. And it gets easier in direct proportion to the effort we make right from the beginning of Sesshin. Effort, I hasten to say, effort doesn't mean straining and becoming tense. Effort just means repeatedly, persistently returning our attention to the practice every time we notice that our mind has wandered. That's really effort. Just back again and again and again to the practice. And not straining. And then he rhetorically asks, were there any ancients who realized the path who did not come from perfectly ordinary people? In all the sutras and commentaries, is there any which forbids sentient beings in the degenerate age to practice the non-outflow path? As it is stated in the Complete Enlightenment Sutra, and here he quotes, if there is any sentient being, and by sentient being, this is the way they refer to the so-called unenlightened beings. Is there any sentient being in the degenerate age whose mind does not give rise to falsity? No, if there is any such person, the Buddha has said that such a one is a bodhisattva who has appeared in the world. And then he quotes the Avatamsaka Sutra again. It is said, if anyone says that this Dharma is not suited to ordinary people, but is a practice reserved for bodhisattvas, then it should be known that this one destroys the knowledge and vision of Buddhahood and annihilates the right Dharma. That is, anyone who says such a thing. And then Chinu himself says, anyone with wisdom should not be of the same opinion or be lax in his practice. Even though our practice may have brought no results so far, we should not forget our seeds of goodness which can mature into superior conditions, bringing the practice to perfection in future lives. Let me pause here and go back over. This is important. Even though our practice may have brought no results so far, of course, this is impossible if you're really practicing, which means sitting every day or mostly every day, you're going to see results. Unless you're sitting just 5 minutes every day, well, you're not going to see much there. But if you're sitting just a decent chunk of time every day, you will see results. But he said, even if one were to see no results, he says, remember that our good karma, that's what he means by our seeds of goodness, our good karma can mature into superior conditions. It's easy to become dismayed at, in Sesshin, at our weakness of concentration and how persistently the mind will just go off, and how unruly the mind is. It's beginners can sometimes get discouraged at realizing what we're up against in this practice. We're up against a real enemy, this force, the forces of dispersion, of grasping at thoughts. But this is where the faith comes in. Faith in the practice, fundamentally. That if we can stick with it and just sincerely do our best, even though it feels like we're spinning our wheels, if we can just keep at it, then it will change. It will get better. We can't control the results. We bring our mental conditioning, our mental baggage in with us, and we have to work with it. We all have our mental obstructions, and those things will be heard. But what we can control is our efforts. We can keep making the effort without getting attached to results. So we may feel like we're just spinning our wheels, but we can keep our foot on the gas pedal. And not to the floor. We know that doesn't work. But we can find a way just by hanging in there, by not just getting out of the car and walking into the snowy night. We can find a way to work with it. And it's not complicated. We don't have to strategize. That would be complicated if we had to, let's see now, what should I do about all this? No, it's moo! The breath. There's no figuring out how to go. It's just how we direct our attention, on what we place our attention. And even if we still see few or, if any, results, back again to faith, the truth is that the sitter herself does not see most of what's happening. It's like that old analogy of the iceberg. Most of our progress is not visible to the sitter himself. If you're working hard, certainly that means if you're in Sesshin, you can't not be working hard. I mean, just hanging in, sticking it out is a tremendous thing. If you're doing that, then there is a cleansing that's happening. There is a purifying of the mind that's happening whether you see it or not. And if you persist at it long enough, then you will see it. You will see that it was happening all along. And then he quotes another Buddhist text called Secrets on Mind Only. He says, even if one hears the Dharma but does not believe, it is still the cause for the fruition of the seed of Buddhahood. Even though one trains but has no success, it still has merit superior to that of humans and gods. That's the quote. So this is a remarkable thing, if it's true, that even if we don't buy it, to hear this teaching of mind only, to hear this teaching of non-duality, is to sow good karma. This is what's so exhilarating about introductory workshops is you realize that even if the people don't ever come back or don't practice, at least they're hearing it. They're hearing this teaching of oneness, this teaching that points beyond the world of phenomena, the world of dichotomies and suffering. It's not unusual that we will hear from someone who says, I went to a workshop several years ago. I went to a workshop 20 years ago, and I guess I wasn't ready for it at the time, but now I've never forgotten it, and I feel now it's time. I want to do this. Sometimes this shift is prompted by some kind of loss in their lives. That's what tends to soften us up when we go through suffering, and soften us up and open us up to this radiant, peerless teaching. What could be more exalted than the teaching of the formlessness of form? That within this very world of form and phenomena, this world of appearances, it is all one's own mind. And that we don't have to be caught in it. He continues, when we investigate from this standpoint, there is no need to discuss the differences between the periods of degenerate Dharma and right Dharma. There is no need to worry about whether our minds are dark or bright. We need only to give rise to a mind of faith, practice according to our ability, bring the right cause to fruition, and leave behind all faint-heartedness. We should know that worldly pleasures do not last for long and that the right Dharma is difficult to hear. How can we be slack and waste this human birth? If we think it over, for ages we have undergone to no avail all kinds of bodily and mental suffering which have been of no benefit to us. At present, we are still obliged to suffer unfathomable oppression. Our future suffering is limitless, difficult to abandon and difficult to escape. And yet, we still are not aware of it. Might just say that the suffering most of us know is nothing like the suffering that these monks in 12th century Korea knew. That is, certainly the daily physical hardships, which I think many people, they think of suffering as physical. Of course, we know that some of the worst suffering is mental suffering. But leading the life of a monk in a monastery, it's so much more simple. It's such a simple life. You don't have the suffering of extended family issues, the suffering of your children suffering, even your parents suffering, because being a celibate monk means renouncing one's home. It's all the suffering is right there in the monastery, and it's as Americans, as Westerners, most of us have little, if any, experience of a kind of the hunger. Just starting with the hunger, this was a common thing in the monasteries. The cold. So many forms of suffering. We in this country have been able to get beyond. One of the many things in this book that we won't have time to read is a section where he talks about the rules of monastic community, which became accepted and standardized as the rules of Korean monastic Zen. One of those rules, just to get kind of earthy here, one of the rules is you're not to wash your clothes except on the sixth day. I guess that means every sixth day. And here, let me, rather than stumbling through it, let me read this footnote. Just a little tiny example of what life was like. Okay, one of the rules is, if it is not a sixth day, do not wash your underwear. And the footnote says, a sixth day refers to a tradition has it that on the 16th and 26th day of each lunar month, the saints convene and redeem the spirits of insects. So if you wash your underclothes on those days and unintentionally kill lice and other insects, they will be reborn in the Pure Land and you will not have violated the precept against killing. Yeah. Ah, yes. Very funny about those lice. Our future suffering, he continues, our future suffering is limitless, difficult to abandon and difficult to escape, and yet we still are not aware of it. Moreover, the life of this body is unstable, impermanent, and difficult to protect for even a moment. Even the spark of a flint, the wind extinguishing a lamp, the receding of a wave, or the last glow of the setting sun are inadequate analogies. He's talking here, of course, about the ephemeral nature of life, the fragile, he's talking about the law of impermanence. The rush of months and years is swift, implacable. It debilitates the elderly form. With the mind ground as yet uncultivated, we gradually approach the portal of death. We think of our old acquaintances. I think of Facebook, you know, finding old acquaintances. We think of our old acquaintances, yet however wise or foolish they might have been, one morning you count up and nine have died and only one is still living, and he is becoming more decrepit. But regardless of however much this has happened in the past, we are still unrestrained, greedy, angry, jealous, envious, conceited, and heedless. We pursue fame and profit, wasting all our days. We discuss worldly affairs in pointless conversations. We accept the gifts of the faithful without maintaining our moral precepts. To accept the gifts without maintaining our moral precepts is barren of merit. We receive the offerings of others without shame or dread. These vices are incalculable and boundless. How can they be ignored? Is it not tragic? He's only 33 when he wrote this. Actually, I may be a little older than that. 11, 9. Okay, so Yeah, that's how old he is, 33. And yet he has the imagination, and this is what it takes for people in their teens or 20s or 30s or maybe 40s. He has the imagination, the foresight to recognize that things will eventually fall apart. This is a perspective that comes, of course, it becomes much easier, it's much more obvious when you get into your 50s and 60s and so forth, how quickly time passes. To young people, time often seems to drag. It just can't, you can't get older fast enough. But then that changes, and you see that these analogies, like the last glow of the setting sun, the receding of a wave, our perspective changes, and we come to recognize that, yeah, maybe we won't live forever, and maybe this is a priceless opportunity now that we have encountered the Dharma, encountered this practice. What an opportunity to see through this whole world of the world of change, the world of suffering, the world of deterioration and loss. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.